Well, here's the question as we start this morning, and that is, who do you identify most closely with in the Christmas story? You know, if we were visiting over a beverage of some sort, I wonder how you would answer that question. Like Mary? Like, no, I don't think so. Joseph? We don't really know that much about him. The shepherds? Maybe, because they were kind of scared. The Magi? It's like, well, what even is that? You know, sweet baby Jesus? Like, no. You know, sadly, I'm afraid that the person that I most closely identify with is the one that we would consider the villain of the Christmas story, King Herod. And I think that what we're going to discover this morning is that for most of us, that there's a little bit of King Herod in all of us. Now, King Herod, he was a client king of Judah, which means that Rome made him the king of Judah. He wasn't even Jewish, which kind of drove all the Jewish people crazy. He was the king of Judea in the time that Christ was born. He was very smart. He was very talented. He was very politically astute. He was very, very ambitious. He was known in that day as a builder king because he rebuilt the Jewish temple. He built aqueducts. He built a port. He built fort cities. He built all kinds of things, and he was an extraordinary person when it came to his talent, but his ambition got the best of him in the end, which again, I think we're going to discover that there's a little bit of King Herod in all of us. Now, as we begin this morning, I'm going to give you a little bit of fascinating background to King Herod, things that you won't find in your Bible, but that are actually very important. Most of us in high school or college, you studied Julius Caesar. You studied that story, and you know there's been movies made, you know, Et tu, Brute, you know, and you, Brutus. You know, the Senate has him killed in the Senate. I mean, very interesting political times. So we kind of have those today. Well, this was about 44 B.C., So 44 B.C., when he died, and we're going to put some names up here for you. He had two individuals. He had Mark Antony, who was his friend, and then his nephew, Octavius, who would eventually become Caesar Augustus. Now, they decide that they're going to avenge the death of their friend and their uncle, Julius Caesar. And so, basically, they went around, they become allies, and then they go around, they begin to destroy all of the people that had anything to do with the assassination of Julius Caesar. Now, to put this in more modern terms, kind of think Survivor or the Hunger Games, because they were allies in the process, but in the end, there can only be one victor, okay? As time goes by and all these enemies are destroyed, eventually people knew that it was going to be the two of these having to come up against each other. And to get one more movie quote in there, there can be only one, okay? So some of you know Highlander back a million years ago. So as they progress in this mission to avenge the death of Julius Caesar, these two guys, they gain more and more power. Each of them have an allegiance, or they have the support, the allegiance of a certain number of Roman legions. Well, then in comes King Herod, and King Herod, you've got Mark Antony and Octavius, they're both rising to power, and King Herod befriends Mark Antony. Okay, and some of you would know he had a wife, he had a very famous wife from Egypt. Anybody know who Mark Antony's wife was? Cleopatra. Oh, you guys are so smart. So that's right, Cleopatra. So, Roman citizens hated Cleopatra. Because you know she's from Egypt, and so they were afraid there'd be all this intermingling and they trying the adoption of some Egyptian ways, whatever. They had misgivings about Cleopatra, but because of his friendship and his allegiance, King Herod, he's like sending lavish gifts to Mark Antony, and he supports them in this rebellion that happens right outside of Alexandria, and so they develop this friendship, and so this time goes by. And Mark Antony and Octavius, they become more and more famous, are gaining more and more power. Eventually, there is a civil war between these two individuals, but it is very short. It does not last a long time. And unfortunately, Herod bet on the wrong horse because Mark Antony is very quickly defeated. And so he and Cleopatra end up running back to, hightailing back to Alexandria. And within a very short period of time, Julius Caesar's nephew, Octavius, he becomes Caesar Augustus, the very first emperor of Rome. So the civil war has happened. It's over quickly. Herod realizes, uh-oh, I bet on the wrong guy. And so he basically has three options. You can go ahead and just kill yourself and get it over with. You can go ahead and run, but they're going to find you eventually. Or you can just hunker down and hope they ignore you and have more important things to do. But Herod, again, he's so driven. He He's so astute and ambitious, and he's all about his legacy. He chooses a fourth option that actually turns out to be an amazing, incredibly smart political move. He gets on a boat to the island of Rhodes, where he knows the new Caesar is going to be, Caesar Augustus, the emperor. He shows up. He basically knocks on the door, says, "I would like to speak to the emperor of the Roman Empire, now the most powerful man in the world." And everybody's looking at him like, "What are you doing here? You're an enemy of the state. I mean, eventually we're going to come and get you, but you've come to us." So Caesar Augustus, he hears who's arrived. It's like, seriously, Herod, king of Judea, he supported my adversary, but they let him in. He gives this incredible speech before Octavius and all of his supporters and all the people that are there. And he basically says this. He says, "As you know, I was a friend and a supporter of Mark Antony. I was a loyal supporter of his through the beginning, through the Civil War, and to the very end. So what you know about me is this, that when I pledge my loyalty to somebody, I am loyal to them to the very end. And oh, great Caesar, I pledge my loyalty to you." Well, the emperor is so impressed. Not only does he not kill him or take the kingdom, he actually gives him more. He ends up giving him Samaria, Jericho, and Gaza as well, and sends him back with his blessing. So that's King Herod. Super bright guy, very politically astute. He's extremely ambitious. And the thing that got him in trouble was that he was so committed to his own control. He was so committed to his own power, his own legacy, that he just continued to make bad decision after bad decision after bad decision. He changed his will 4 times. For some of you, you're married, you think you have trouble with one wife. He had 10 wives, okay? He killed one of them. He had all these sons, and he would get a favorite son and say, "You're going to be the next one," and then that son would fall out of favor with him. He'd go ahead and change his will, have that son executed. He did this two or three times, and finally the rest of the boys were like, "Dad, it's really okay. We don't want to be king. It's okay." So after a while, this continues to happen, but he was so committed to controlling and growing his kingdom that and wanting this legacy, and he wanted there forever and ever for there to be someone who was related to him on the king of the throne of Judea, as a king of the throne on Judea. He killed one of his wives again. He murdered so many rabbis in Jerusalem and Judea that rabbis didn't want to go anywhere near the city of Jerusalem. Because when King Herod got mad, if he perceived anyone or anything was a threat to his power or his reputation or his control, he would do whatever he felt like he needed to do to maintain that, to maintain control and power over his kingdom and his legacy. Now, when we get to the biblical narrative about the birth of Jesus, King Herod, he's in his late 60s. He is suffering from a very, very painful kidney disease, combined with a maggot-infested gangrene of a body area that I'm not going to describe because the men in the room would faint. He's very, very sick. He's trying to consolidate his power. He's trying to ensure the next generation carries on his legacy. And then he gets the most disturbing news imaginable. Now, again, for us, this is typically the front end of the Christmas story, because he hears that 5 miles south of him, a new king has been born, and that new king is about to learn how to walk. And this is the most disturbing news for him. There's this new king. And here's how Matthew introduces the story. Matthew writes, "After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, where Herod is king, during the time of King Herod, Magi," or we call them wise men when we were growing up, "Magi from the east come from Jerusalem, and they asked." And so now, having a bit of the background of King Herod, you can imagine how this question settles in the minds of the people as they're going around town and they're wandering around the city of Jerusalem asking this question: where is the one that's been born king of the Jews? Everybody's like, "Shh, what are you doing? Keep it down. Where's the one that's been born king? We came to Jerusalem because it's the capital city, so we know he has to be near. Where's the one that's been born king of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose, and we've come to worship him." And when King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all of Jerusalem with him. And again, now that you understand the backstory of Herod, you understand why all of Jerusalem was disturbed with him. Because when King Herod was disturbed, it became dangerous. When King Herod was disturbed, people died. He was likely to do anything. And now he's an older man. He's in pain. And now suddenly, his legacy is in his future, his control of his kingdom is being threatened and is at risk. The story continues. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, and again, you've got to imagine this, because again, if you're a Jew, if you're terrified to go in front of this man. So he's calling these people who've got all the power and all the religious insight. He calls them into one meeting. He asked them where the Messiah was to be born. And they said to him, in Bethlehem. And they're thinking, you should know this. You're the king of the Jews. Like, everybody should know this. In Bethlehem, in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem. In other words, this was predicted many, many, many years before. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For you, out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people, Israel. This is like the worst news imaginable for Herod. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time that the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child, and as soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them, and it stopped over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Now, this word worship, in modern church, we sometimes make this synonymous with singing. And that can be a form of worship. But worship is basically when you recognize that you're in the presence of someone that should cause you to have awe. When you're in the presence of someone that you just know that this is someone that I have awe for, that I have respect for, and that essentially doing whatever you can or whatever you need to do physically or mentally to submit, to surrender yourself to them. So these very wealthy men, they've traveled a long, long way. They're in the presence of a baby that has no physical power, but because of who they believed he was, they drop to their knees and they worship. And about 5 miles away, Herod is worried to death. You can just imagine him going around the palace like, have you seen those guys? Has anybody heard? Somebody needs to go out on the road. They need to watch for them. I need to know when they're coming back. Because he's so worried about controlling things. His whole life has been around preserve, protect, and control. Preserve, protect, and control. Preserve, protect, and control. And that's why I say there's a little bit of Herod in all of us. Because there's that thing in us that just drives us to preserve, to protect, and to control. It's like, because I'm like you. I don't mind leveraging God if he's going to help me build my kingdom. I don't mind, you know, going to church or reading the Bible or even saying the prayer if all these things will help me in building the things that I want to build. All these things, if they'll help facilitate my future, I'm all for it. But the whole idea of giving God a blank check with my life, the whole idea of worshiping, of surrender, of just whatever the question is, the answer is yes. Whatever the assignment is, the answer is yes. Like, that just does not come natural for any of us, this idea of surrender. And Herod, he's got his fist clenched. And even though he is racked with pain, he is not about to bow his knee to anyone. He is not about to worship anyone or anything that threatens his agenda, the kingdom he's trying to build. The story continues. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, he said. Take the child and the mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and they left for Egypt. And you kind of hear the soundtrack in the background beginning to build up. When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. And when Herod was furious, people were terrified. Because again, when Herod was furious, people were harmed. People suffered. People died. Because he had spent his whole life, and again, especially for those of us that are men, I feel like it's important that we hear this, that he spent his whole life trying to control outcomes. Control outcomes. Control outcomes. No matter what happened, he'd always been able to figure out a way to fix things. And as men, like, isn't that like our go-to? We always want to fix things, right? There's a problem. Let's just fix it. You know, especially in a relationship, that always works well. We always try to control the outcomes, but men don't hold the corner on trying to control outcomes, do they, ladies? And you ever find yourself just filled with anxiety and trying to control outcomes when it connects to your future, or filled with anxiety and trying to control outcomes when it's about your children, your relationship? So there's a little Herod in all of us, and he was the master of controlling outcomes, so he thought. And once again, he thought he'd figured out a way to outsmart destiny. And instead, he's been outsmarted by a baby and a couple of Jewish parents. But he had decided long ago that no matter what happened, my legacy, my control, my power will not be threatened. And he certainly would not be thwarted in the end by some baby king. And so he gave these orders that we can't even imagine giving. And he gave instructions to his soldiers that we can't even imagine following through on, unless you know the story of King Herod, that this is the kind of guy that would have your entire family wiped out if you didn't do his bidding and what he wanted. And he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. If you're not going to bring me the one, if you're not going to identify the location of the one, then we'll just go with the nuclear option and we'll just take them all out. We will just kill all the baby and toddler boys. And they did. One horrible morning, a horrible afternoon, one horrible evening, his soldiers roll into this tiny town of Bethlehem. They burst into every single house, every single hut in that area, in the surrounding area, the farmhouses. They pull out any little boy that looks like that he could be about that age, and they slaughter him in front of his parents and his family. And they killed anybody that tried to interfere. Have you ever tried to really wrap your mind around that? Have you ever thought about the fact that Mary had to live with that the rest of her life? With the knowledge, her entire life, knowing that in an effort to protect her own son, one of the darkest moments in history happened. Violent death to helpless, innocent children. Indescribable pain to helpless mothers and fathers and family members. And you just imagine the darkness of this moment. Soon, very soon, in fact, probably within that same year, Herod died a terrible, painful death because of his kidney disease and this gangrene. In fact, it was so painful, he tried to commit suicide. Now, no guns in the first century. So your two main options were a knife or poison. And Herod opted to stab himself. That the pain of the disease was so bad that he would rather inflict more pain on himself by stabbing himself. And just as he was killing himself, his cousin walked in and found him and ended up saving him and saving his life. And Herod continued to suffer. And just before he died, Herod gave this command. He said, "You're to round up all of the influential and respected and distinguished men of Jerusalem. I want you to round them all up and I want you to put them all in prison. And in the hour that I die, you are to execute all of them. Because I want there to be mourning in Israel on the day of my death." Because he knew. He knew that when he died, there would be a national party in the streets and a celebration. Herod died, and they released all of those men and did not follow through with his orders. The text continues, "After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said once again, 'Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those that were trying to take the child's life are dead.'" And the man known as King Herod of Judea, the man known as Herod the Great, in this incredible twist of fate that we believe was providential, Herod the Great, who did so many amazing things, becomes a footnote in the story of Jesus the toddler. And can you imagine trying to explain to him in the last few hours that he was alive, "Herod, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news. The good news is that 2,000 plus years from now, all over the world, in places and languages that you can't even imagine, places that haven't even been discovered yet, they're going to talk about you. I mean, people are going to gather in rows and circles, and they're going to read a story, and they're going to read about you. That's fantastic. That's the good news. The bad news is that you're simply a B character. You're simply a sidebar. You are a footnote in the story of a toddler. The toddler that you tried to have killed, that became king and savior of the world. And people won't really talk about what you built. They won't talk about the seaport or the aqueducts, or you won't be known by in most circles as Herod the Builder, but instead you'll be known as Herod the Butcher. You were 5 miles away from the birth of the Son of God. And you missed your opportunity to truly be great. Decades later, Herod is long gone. Decades later, Jesus, he's grown to become a man, performed miracles, died on a cross, rose from the dead, ascended to be with the Father. Decades later, Caesar is long gone. Tiberius is long gone. Nero is gone. The temple has been the temple that Herod had built completely destroyed. Every single one of those huge stones dragged to the edge of the Temple Mount and thrown down. All that work, all those years, all that glory, and the Jewish temple that Herod had spent so many years and so much money and so much of his life developing, it's just all gone. And decades later, John, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John who actually took Mary from the foot of the cross and took her as his mother, and she took him as his son, who heard the birth narrative over and over again. John, who had the opportunity to ask Mary questions, like, Mary, what was it like fleeing from Egypt? What was it like leaving, knowing that it might not fare so well for the kids that you left behind? Mary, what was it like when you got news of what happened in Bethlehem? John, who saw every miracle, who watched Jesus do things no one had ever done. John, who had watched Jesus die. John, who then peered into an empty tomb and then saw his resurrected Savior and then had breakfast with him on a beach. He's an old man. And he's looking back on all of this narrative, all of this that he has seen and experienced firsthand. And he decides to sit down and summarize it. And he says this, In him, this baby of Bethlehem who grew to be a man, who grew to become my friend. In him, past tense, was life. And that life was, past tense, the light of all mankind, not just to Jews, but to everybody. John would say, at first we thought it was just for the Jews. It was just our Jewish Messiah. It was just an extension of our Jewish scriptures. But then one day Jesus said, no, you're to go into all the world. You're to go into all the world and teach everything I've taught you. I'm not just a Jewish Messiah, that he had come for all mankind. And he pauses and he chooses to move from the past tense to the present tense to send you and to send me a message. He was the life and light of all mankind, and the light shines. The light shines, present tense, right now, in the darkness, and the light shines. And again, you have to remember who's writing this. This is John. He is living in some of the darkest days in history. He's been exiled to the island of Patmos. It looks like the Romans have won. The ancient Jewish Jewish temple will never be resurrected. Ancient Judaism is gone forever. He has lost all of his friends. They've all been executed one by one, and he is one of the last, if not the last ones, of his close friends who decades before that he had shared with these individuals one of the greatest experiences that any man has ever experienced on this earth in history, as he walked the cities and walked the byways and the streets and the pathways with Jesus. They're all gone. Each coming to a brutal end. He looks back on what he's experienced. He says, you know what? That life, that light, it continues to shine. It continues to shine right now. And then he punctuates this with this powerful remark. And the darkness has not overcome it. The darkness has not been able to capture it or to blow it out. And that brings us to you. What will your story be? What will your story be in relation to the light of the world? Because one day somebody will be forced to stand in front of a group of friends and family and well-wishers, and they're going to tell your story in relationship to the light of the world. You know that, right? And at your funeral, your memorial, someone, probably someone who loved you, they're going to tell your story. And will it be a story, the question is, will it be a story of the Magi or the story of more like Herod? Will your story be a story of worship or a story of resistance? Will it be a story that you spent your whole life like Herod trying to build your own kingdom instead of accepting the invitation to be a part of what God is building, to be a part of God's kingdom? Will your story be that you clung as tightly as you could to all the things that eventually you would have to leave and give up anyways? Or will it be a story of a man or a woman that surrendered everything they came their way because they realized it wasn't theirs to begin with? Will your life and will your story be a story about my way, or will it be about God's way? Will it be about my will, or will it be about God's will? And the reason there's tension, the reason why there's a struggle, is because we're human. And because there's a little Herod in all of us. But one day, someday, somebody will be forced to tell your story in relationship to the light of the world. And either they're going to have to make something up to try and make it sound good, or they'll be able to tell a true story. How at some point in your life, even though maybe there was a time where you drifted for a time, maybe there was a time where you lost hope, where life just seemed to stamp the hope and stamp the light and stamp the life out of you. And at some point, though, you realize that, no, there is still light. There is still life that came and comes through Jesus Christ. And at some point, you came back, even if you drifted for a while. Because one day, someday, somebody will tell your story in relationship to the light of the world. And the question that only you can answer is, what story do you want to be told? And here's what I think is the good news. Like, I don't even have to know you. But what I suspect is that even with all the darkness that you've experienced, all the disappointments, all that you've seen, the struggle, the disappointments, the unanswered prayers, all the people that maybe let you down or they hurt you, they didn't do what they were supposed to do in your life, maybe all the hypocrisy that you've seen in individuals or even within a church, whatever it is, with all the darkness, it's still not overcome the light that is in you. That you sense. It's not overcome. And that's why you're here today. That's why you're listening online. That's why for some of you, every once in a while, you find yourself having a conversation with God in whom there are moments that maybe in this season you struggle to believe He's there anymore. Because the darkness cannot overwhelm it. It cannot overcome it. The darkness cannot blow it out. So I just want to encourage you in this Christmas season, whether you're just exploring or whether you've been a follower of Jesus, you know, you're new to this or you've been doing it for decades, you just take a step back, and this is a good time to look back on 2018 and just evaluate as you move towards the new year. Has it primarily for you been about preserve, protect, and control, or follow, surrender, and trust? For some of you, there's been some things, you know, this last year, it's time to loosen your grip on. And it's time to let some things go. And to begin to renew your trust in your Heavenly Father and in following Jesus. For some of you, you're here, you've been coming, maybe you've been listening online, but the truth is that deep down, you've been keeping God at an arm's distance. Like, you may show up, but then Monday through Saturday, God's kind of at an arm's distance. And you're still operating in the mode of preserve, protect, control, sitting on the throne of your life. And I just want to encourage you to take that baby step forward in engaging or re-engaging the light of the world, the light of Jesus Christ, maybe for the first time. So here's the thing, and then I'm done. The Magi got it right. In fact, I'm going to invite the band to come on up. We're going to close with a song today, and you just ignore them for just a second. But think about it. The Magi got it right, because when you're in the presence of holiness, when you're in the presence of light, when you're in the presence of someone that is awe-inspiring, all you can do is worship. So in these final few minutes, I just want to give you the opportunity to just process what you've heard. Think about the ways where maybe you've been in the mode of preserve, protect, and control, and to turn towards increased follow, surrender, and trust. It may be in saying a prayer. Maybe you haven't prayed in a while. It may be going home, opening your Bible, and just getting in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, maybe for the first time in a long time, and just putting yourself at the feet of Jesus and discovering who he is and what he was like. For some of you, it's, you know what, we're going to get more connected, or we're going to become more consistent, or I'm done sitting on the sidelines or just consuming. We're going to take a step up and begin serving or serving more, or step into a small group. Or, you know, again, you heard this morning, we've been talking about this New Life 2019 year-end goal, and to position us to truly impact the next generation. And maybe you decide, you know what, I want to be a part of that. Or as we move into this next year, I want to become a more generous person, and I'm going to do that. I'm going to invest in the things that are important to God. I don't know what your first step is, but odds are you do. And if you're not sure, we say often, you fill out one of these orange cards. You can put it in the giving box. It's just you, and I'll be able to meet with you and have a conversation and figure it out together. You don't have to do it alone. But during this Christmas season, just I want to ask you to consider taking a step back and just doing some evaluation, and maybe what's become the status quo in your life. Maybe for some of you, you've just been feeling so driven and so busy and so distracted, and there's screens and entertainment and ways to escape and preserve, protect, control, to take a step back from all that and begin to re-engage in a new way with the light of the world, in a new and fresh way, because the light is still in you. No matter what you do, how far you wander, what sin there might be in your past, whatever it is, the light is not going out. You can always take that step back. So here's the great thing about this song, and we've actually never sung it here. It's 16 years old, but many of you have heard it. Some of you have never heard it before. But this song brings together this amazing idea that Christ, the light of the world, stepped into darkness. He stepped into darkness in such a way that many people respond in worship. Light of the world, you step down into darkness. Humbly you came to the earth you created, and for love's sake, you became poor. So here I am to worship. Here I am to bow down. Here I am to say that you are my God. So you can stay seated if you want and just listen. You can sing if you want, but ultimately, whatever that thing is that's rattling around in your conscience, you like that ends with a "I ought to," or begins with "I ought to do this as I'm moving into this new year," and then you get busy and you don't do it. That in this Christmas season, that you would not miss this opportunity of what God may want to do in you and through you.